Okay.
A cup, we're all mosaics, let me say that.
I have to say, this is the second tape of the interview with Harold Campbell.
We're all mosaics. I learned this and brought it home so dramatically from Andy Peterson, one of Charlie Heidelberger's postdocs here that I worked with. Programming, I run programs for Charlie and his people while they were here, modeling some of the systems that Charlie Heidelberger was running. But Andy Peterson, and I have this as a picture in my mind, he often was inclined to say, "Oh, Campy, but it's not all bad." Right. Like, no, Andy, nothing we ever got into that Andy couldn't say, "Oh, but Campy, it's not all bad." I learned this from Andy and interpret it this way. Not all bad. That's right. I don't know any all bad people or all bad situations. On another one, I go as a corollary to it. I don't know any of them all good. I have not found any all good. I'm sure I'm not, and I haven't found others, see? Not all good. Carl was a tremendous mosaic. We all are. I am. Caricature, man. Not just a character, a caricature. Carl was a great mosaic. He had tremendous strong places, and of course, like all of us, not all good. None of us are. And we hear a lot of stories come true, particularly those that standing off on the side, and the moment I just tie into is like the three blind people who went to circus and saw the elephant. You know the story?
Yes.
It's easy to get stories about Carl Paul Link that are, oh, no doubt, true, valid. Mm-hmm. But in that tremendous mosaic, let's not assume all of it was that way, because Carl wasn't. He was a tremendous mosaic, and he played it up. He played it up to the limit, see? Well, I've learned something from Carl. I probably wouldn't be talking the way I do today if I hadn't, see? Sure. Carl was a tremendous showman.
You liked him?
Oh, tremendous guy. I'm very, very fortunate to fall under the influence of Carl Paul Link, because Carl Paul Link didn't treat all people the same either. He not just had one pat way of doing it. He didn't, those that couldn't do better, or didn't do better, they did Carl Paul's bidding. We see now so many PhD candidates that turn out to be a glorified lab assistant doing the professor's research. Over and over again, tremendous. Well, Carl wasn't adverse to treating a person that way in his opinion, that was the way he was best treated. He could learn something, and he could do research that way. On the other hand, Carl didn't, he was a tremendous teacher, he didn't treat everybody that way. He didn't treat Stan Moore that way, working right across the bench from me, the Nobel Prize winner, working on how do you analyze amino acids when nobody knows how to analyze amino acids and the amino acid content of proteins in those days. Real problems, we didn't know how to do it. That's the reason Stan was working on it. Encouraged by Paul.
So his different treatment of people was according to their quality. Is that right?
They were treated differently. They were treated differently. No, I'm not gonna try to say why or how, but Carl was a tremendous teacher. He could do that. He did do it. Now, why he did it, or why, what ability, you can surmise. He did treat people differently. When he come to me, well, you know, I was, well, campy. I mean, one of them myself. And not adverse to running and grabbing something and going, for all it's worth. Give it a college try, for all it's worth. And as I envision and remember Carl and the way he treated me, he was always right there if I needed help. Probably laying over on the couch half the time. I was right outside of Carl's lab, and the couch was right next to him. Sure, he was there. There if I needed him. But he never tried to make a glorified lab assistant or treated me as a glorified lab assistant. It was always, Campy, you can do it. Go, go, go. Campy, you can do it. Go. Encouragement? Yeah. Confidence? Yeah. But now it's Campy, why don't you try this next? As soon as he'd do this, Carl would have had the experience of manipulating the experimental method, and he might have been successful. And he could have built on his strength in his field. I might have been better at following instructions, but I wouldn't have had the experience of manipulating the experimental method and making new creative discoveries. Someplace you have to...
He didn't say, why don't you do this next? He let you think it up yourself. Is that what you said?
Of course. Yes, for me. Mm-hmm. There were some others. He was always had a program for them to run.
And that's because they couldn't do it themselves, presumably. It wasn't that he was arbitrary.
I can only think of Will Rogers. Yeah, I just know what I read in the newspapers. I only know what I saw. That's what I saw.
Yeah. Did they object?
Not that I could observe. People that need that don't object. People that need that need it.
Oh, okay. That's what I...
People that need it, need it.
Yeah. So
they don't object.
So he was doing it according to the quality.
And if you can't run fast enough, Carl would do it to anybody. And he would do it to anybody. But if you can run fast enough, Carl wasn't adverse to working with those kind of people and training them. Campy, you can do it. Oh, let them go.
He actually would say that.
Oh, yes. Maybe not in those words, but the message was, that's the message. I don't know what he said. That's the message I got.
Yeah.
I said, what I did. I don't know what he said.
Did he understand what you were doing all the time? Did he keep up with it?
As close as, yes, we were a very special group there. We had special, different than the rest of the department. We had a key. There was two doors came into the Link, complex. The rest of them had laboratories here, laboratories. The professor had his own laboratory somewhere else. Link had his laboratory within the Link complex. You come in with your key and you're inside, Mm-hmm. I always saw Link's door closed and locked maybe once or twice. I can never remember in my life. Once you get in, Carl couldn't get to his office or no one else without almost pushing me up against my bench because I was just right outside. And inside we had a conference room back in the back. Tradition at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we had tea and you sit down and talk about things of the day or things of the world or
the
once in a while.
Huh? The graduate students.
Only graduate students. Carl's own PhD candidates, yeah. His own students right there.
And he was there too.
And Carl was right there. And once in a while we'd have the good fortune of having Linus Pauling, one of Carl's friends, stop in. And what a tremendous experience for the students. Because you say, I sit there and I say, if I could figure out how that guy, Pauling, his mind runs, boy, wouldn't I be lucky, see? So we ask him questions, see if we can find out how his mind runs, because after all, he's been out on the front, and he's at the front. How does it look at the front? How do you operate at the front? How do you get there? How do you solve brand new problems when there is no guidelines at all? You know, these are the kind of things that every student for himself. I don't know what the other students were thinking about, but I know what I was thinking about. I said, boy, here's a brain I can pick, if I can pick the best I can, see? Tremendous experience there. Tea in the afternoon, an hour, 2 hours, you know? Every day we had tea time, around 4 o'clock. Mm-hmm. Carl was there, of course Carl was there, of course. What is the day? World Affairs, I mentioned Lionel Pauling, you recognize, we went just working with molecules, sometimes you're working with people. We're all interested in people, real people, see? Even Dacumo is with real people, see? Stan Moore working on how do we determine the amino acids so we can determine the amino acid sequences so we can then better understand the proteins from which those enzymes that are the machines by which people operate. They gave him a Nobel Prize after he got learned how to do this for ribonuclease, the enzyme. Of course, the real problems, but real people problems too. Problems we didn't know how to solve. But were we just applying all we had available to us to solve? And so, sure, Carl was there, we know Carl, we're within a particular little Carl group, PhD candidates, there were no, everybody, once we get in the door, everybody was the same. Carl knew what was going on, sure. On Fridays, one person stood up in front and had an hour to explain the discoveries he'd made in the last 2 months, see? Mm-hmm. Taking turns, rotation, see? So we and getting evaluations and comments from your colleagues sitting there, your other students, as well as Carl, of course. We knew what was going on. And we could learn from others, because we could learn from what they were doing, and with our own personal computers, figure out, that problem of Mark Stallman working on clubroot disease, a disease of cabbage being an important part in the in Wisconsin, a split major between Carl and Walker, plant pathology. What Mark was trying to do is figure out some way to avoid now cabbage getting this disease clubroot so the farmers could have better cabbage crop, plant pathology. And that was especially, Carl was interested in plant pathology. He took his degree from Tottenham. Tottenham was still living when I was there. Carl's degree, PhD, was in plant chemistry, yeah. Plant pathology. Carl did his work on the red pigment of onions, I believe. Were they protected from certain diseases and others weren't, see? Yeah, plant pathology. Mark Stallman was following that leg of Carl's interest, real problems. Not that we had answered, not just running experiments on it, not just running another chemical reaction, no. What chemical reaction can we run so we better understand what's going on here, see? That was what Stallman was working on, Stan Moore working on amino acids, so we could better understand the proteins and the machinery which people are made, and so we could better understand how they work. And I say, you finally learned how to do that and learned enough about a very important protein, an enzyme, ribonuclease, and he was awarded along with three others, his associate Stan Moore, also there at Rockefeller, and his other another researcher in the same field, three of them get the Nobel Prize for pulling that one off. But it built, and they could see it starting. We go back in Carl's lab. Carl was a good chemist, not just a plant chemist, he was a good chemist. And this was quite, analytical, straight, organic, and inorganic chemistry with Stan Moore. But Stan was running, running on it. I was working on sweet clover. Could we figure out what was in that hay? Mark Stallman trying to figure out what was, how to plant pathology, but you see, Carl had many interests, but they were all real problems of a diversified nature. And where do we learn and catch fire of problem solving? I caught part of this, came up from Illinois with it, but Carl sure furthered it, see?
Did he?
And he was a tremendous teacher. Carl was a tremendous showman, sure. And I've learned some of it from him too. I still, well, I probably wouldn't be talking the way I do if I hadn't come up with a tutelage of Carl Paul Link, see? Sure, of course.
Did he give you these subjects to look into? I mean,
yes, Carl made the assignments as he has described. Well, if you have not read, I recommend you do read his Harvey lecture. His Harvey lecture is a lecture where he described the Dykumro story at the University of New York, given in New York Medical College there in Manhattan. He was invited guest. It was a great honor for him to have this awarded to him. He gave that at one of a grand series of invited lectures, and they're called the Harvey, the great medical man, the Harvey lectures.
And they're published.
And I'll give you that reference. Read that, because that, in my opinion, not only my opinion, after all, I was there. Yeah. That gives as clean a story as far as detail is concerned, as I believe is in print. There's other things missed, left out, of course, but that is a good story. It's early story. It was early in the, after things evolve, of course, and get embellished and modified as things go on in oral tradition. That was an early story. It was an early write-up. It was a very serious write-up. It was a serious situation. It was a prestigious situation. Carl was careful to stay right with the solid facts. This was that kind of a situation. Always a showman. He was there in his showy dress, but with others in tuxedo around him. But it is a good story. There's many other stories, and I don't mean to, cast dispersions, if that's the right word, on them. But Carl was not adverse to embellishing, and he did that with a great flair. That doesn't mean he was being dishonest. Never were dishonest to me, or interpreted as such. Carl was an oral, like, when you called up, you say, well, you were picking up some oral tradition. Maybe my understanding of oral tradition, often the oral tradition and oral history becomes embellished. It tells about and represents a very factual situation, but the details are often modified or somewhat maybe not exactly historical. Carl was a master of this and did it. He was not adverse to doing it and did it very well. The stories that I've read, and I've read a lot of them, Carl wrote a lot of these, the stories I have had, they tell the situation. You get the feeling for the situation. You wouldn't say this is not true. It's true. But the detail often is not historically exact. But now that's the kind of situation it presents now with a person reconstructing this person. Or the history of this person presents him with a tremendous mosaic.
That's exactly the right
and
word.
And think of it as a mosaic. Mm. Consider it as a mosaic. We're all mosaics. I'm a mosaic. Not all good, not all bad. Carl, tremendous, more so than maybe Carl and many others, although I don't know that I'm any less. A tremendous mosaic, think of it that way. The intent maybe, or the general effect, very valid. But don't believe all the detail, because the detail is often contradictory, and for a person like me that was there, old cliche, Charlie, were you there? Yeah, I was there. And many of the details not historically exact, see?
Why did Carl Stammen and Mark Stammen and
yeah.
Link have that series falling out?
Have you talked to Mark Stammen?
No.
You should, of course. He's out of town, I think. Mark Stammen and his wife, Trudy, are very good friends of ours. Very good, and very close friends. My wife and Trudy, very close friends. They when she's up here in this, they're out having coffee, clutch at Rennebaum's or someplace twice a week. I mean, they're very good friends. And Stammen is a good friend of mine, very good friend of mine. We socially, as well as professionally, he always was. That situation, you ought to talk to Mark, and Mark will describe that to you. That is a situation that I think I'm not going to try to make believe I'm a psychologist, although we're all psychologists, whether we admit it or not. But we all practice psychology and often try to make like psychologists, whether we're trained or not. But that is a very understandable situation, where Mark was not part of the Three Clover isolation at all. You asked him, how were their assignment? Mark was assigned and interested in plant pathology and club root in cabbages. That's what he got his degree in. I got mine after running through the obstacle course, as Carl described it in some places, and he put us through an obstacle course. Not as such, but just as, like Will Rogers, you just know what you read in the papers. This is just de facto what happened. And when people come in, this is what happened. It happened to me. He had several projects, little projects. How do you determine lactic acid? Can you improve on it? Well, you really find out if the person is a sloppy analyst or an analyst at all after the first 2 weeks, on see if he can improve the lactic acid method, because it is a slippery thing. After I finished that one, Carl said, Campion, you're going to be my microanalyst. Scheffel was the first microanalyst he had, and he trained me as a microanalyst. He couldn't train everybody as a microanalyst, it takes too much time and effort, but he kept one microanalyst in his lab to do the microanalytical work for the whole group. Campy, you're going to be the microanalyst. Well, sure, no surprise to me. Analytically inclined, mathematically, numerically inclined. This is my nature, this is my forte and interest. It's not surprising. Carl's microanalyst. And if you have not read that story, I don't think that story on Carl has been appreciated nearly as much as it should. Carl Paul Link's contribution to microanalysis in the United States, not in Wisconsin, not in that lab, in the United States. He was first. Carl had the first good, sound microanalytical laboratory in the United States. He studied in Pregel's lab in Germany. Yes, Basel, Germany. That was with
Edinburgh.
He went to Edinburgh, but that's not where you become a microanalyst. He was with Hudson and Ivan Irving in Edinburgh. But after that, he went to Germany. and studied in Prigo, where he studied, and Prigo got a Nobel Prize for discovering and his work in microanalysis. And Carl was there when it was just sure fresh. And Carl came back with equipment in his suitcases and imported equipment in this country and set up the first sound, very elegant, micro lab. Shuffle was his first microanalyst. Shuffle left at the time I came in, and after running an obstacle course, it was no surprise to me, because I'm an analyst by, I don't know where I got it, but I'm by training. My personal computer I already had programmed in analytical thinking when I arrived here. Carl recognized it as a tremendous teacher. He can't be, you're going to be my microanalyst. This is that kind of assignment. And he did. Saturdays and Sundays, do my regular research. After all, you can't spend all week on it. Do dicumal, and this is after running my carbohydrate obstacle course, produced two new compounds, straight chains, five-membered xylose and arabinose, gunky stuff, sticky stuff. You're apt to get loused up, you sure can get loused up in that carbohydrates. But Carl assigned a small project to the man. He find that out pretty quick. After I got through with that one, he said, Kempe, I'm assigning you the dichromo job. That was the biggie. If that was your cup of tea. So I done dichromo, still the microanalyst, so we could on Saturdays and Sundays, dichromo the rest of the week. It was that analytical leg of Carl's, a tremendous personal as well as technical story there in the discovery of the vitamin niacin. I don't know if you're a tremendous story. And actually we can get into that. Yes. I'd like to tell it sometime, but there is a tremendous story in itself there. At that time, due to the situation, hear about the right person at the right time, right person for the age or the time or the situation. Carl had me honed up like a razor blade on microanalysis Saturdays and Sundays, on other work, sugar, until you know how to get the right answer of sugar, no point in working on something else. I was doing any microanalytical man come out with a new product in his Carl's lab, give it to Kempe, and Kempe run carbon hydrogen, see if it's really what he thought it was. See, yeah, that was that kind of, and you're part of my fellowship, if you like. Not my first assignment, but my technical expertise in the lab. And Carl had other people with specialties that were for the lab, as long as their own research they were carrying forward. And so at that time, Elvium had isolated crystals. My friend came up from Illinois same time as I, Nadin. Both came up here at the same time, Nadin for Elvium and I for Carl Pauling. Nadin had pulled out from 500 pounds of beef liver a few little crystals that Elvium's group didn't have the expertise. Potter and other, not that kind of people. Strong, didn't know how to do this, so they brought it in to me and I did. But I was the man that Carl had honed up, and it was only one of maybe three or four labs in the United States by that time. It had caught on. Carl was the first, but there was a few others that could then do the similar thing. Could have been done in three or four labs in the United States. Kempe was honed up and Kempe will do it. Kempe will tell you what it is.
That was it. They came to you and said, what is this? Is that what they did?
Yeah.
Van Potter was.
That's all you know.
Said there are two possibilities. One is this something?
No, they didn't know what it was at all. What is the only edge crystals? No way of knowing. They had tried and couldn't find out. But that's the analytical, micro-analytical leg that I have not seen played up or talked about, except the analytical people know about it. It's in the analytical history. But here locally in Wisconsin, locally at the university, I haven't seen, nor do people seem to hold Carl in high regard as a mosaic. Yeah. For this particular thing, person. Technically, a tremendous thing he did.
Yeah.
And it was not surprising, they don't know that I did, or who's Campion, you know, or who's Campion. It's just not been known. If you can turn that thing off for a minute, if you like. Microlab in the United States. Mm-hmm. Well, we knew that, of course we knew that. But, you know, we're all doing our things. You're right up on the front. We say, well, that one else, of course. We know we're in the front. After all, we're running like hell, and we know we're in the front. There's not no surprise. It's only surprised other people, see? We know it. Of course we know it. But it's just documented. And I'll leave this with you if you like.
Oh, good. Well, thanks.
But this points out that Carl set up but by the time I got there, there was probably three labs in the United States set up that could have done that job. The analytical part could have done the mechanical analyses, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen. The next thing, and we often don't give as much credit to this as I believe we should. What are you going to do with the numbers when you've got them? Lots of people can get numbers. Yeah, good numbers. But the mental construction, the construct, if we say, of how, what does this mean to real people, is takes a different logic, extended logic, different synthesis, mental in the brain, synthesis. How do you go about bringing that together? How do you go back that interpretation? And often that is crucial. It is crucial. You probably always crucial. Always crucial. Always crucial on all of these things. Anybody can get numbers. Yeah. Or you can teach them how to get a number. What's he going to do with it? Dichomer, how are you going to do it? Stan Moore, amino acid analysis. Now that you analyze, you know there's this much glycine, this much alanine, what you going to do with it? What's it going to mean? You applied it to ribonucleus, and then, tremendous advance, understanding of how this machine works in real people. Give him a Nobel Prize, of course.
How was Elvium? What kind of researcher was he? I mean, you say problem solving is...
Elvin was a real problem solver. Steinbach was a real problem solver. E.B. Hart was a real problem solver. E.B. Hart was still there. Took my first course in nutrition from E.B. Hart. Iron. We think way back then. Like as if we always knew we needed a little iron for our blood. But no, E.B. Hart, his advance, his discovery. I had a tremendous experience of not just seeing these people on the stage, but studying under E.B. Hart.
Was he a good teacher?
Excellent teacher. One thing that's not known about E.B. Hart, well, I may be known by quite a little, mine jumps back at that. I wonder E.B. Hart didn't kill himself. E.B. Hart had trouble. We might have been arthritis or gout or something else, but he figured out that he had his trouble was uric acid crystallized in his joints and he painful, and it's a gout situation, has an understanding of biochemistry and nutrition. He said, you know, you probably could dissolve that in, if we had it out here in the beaker, we'd dissolve in hydrochloric acid because it's got some nitrogens on it. It would be soluble in nitric in an acidic solution. And you know, if I ate a little ammonium sulfate, I would use the ammonia and excrete it, urea, just after all, we have a body mechanism for doing that. And I'd be stuck with all that sulfuric acid, and boy, that sulfuric acid running around the blood, that might solubilize those crystals. So he self-diagnosis and self-treatment, a number comes to my mind, but I probably shouldn't name it, because I may have forgotten the exact number. I think it was 15 grams of ammonium sulfate. Nowadays, 15 grams, say, well, my God, that would kill a person. And maybe it's a wonder he didn't get killed. But he felt much better. He was that kind of a guy. We knew this. Us students around him and amongst us, kind of part of the folklore that along with us, we always called him the old man. Wonder the old man is still walking, you know. I saw the old man today. And the other father said, well, I wonder if he's still walking. He hadn't better take any more ammonium sulfate. And you know, that's kind of joshing around. But this is a, yes, he was a good teacher. Steenbach took my first course in vitamins under Steenbach. And a story might be of interest in Steenbach. I don't know how common this is, but Steenbach talking about vitamin D, of course, especially. Talking about, well, how much vitamin D do you need? It wasn't only a course on D, it was all the vitamins. And we did experimental work. We had our own little rats even, and so on. He said, well, you know, one as an adult doesn't need much vitamin D. As a growing individual, of course you need D to put on bones and the like, but as an adult you don't need, maybe you shouldn't have it. Might lay down calcium where you don't need it and give you trouble, an old person. He said, actually you don't need much, you can make your own. Of course, irradiation, of course, this is in his mind, of course. How do you make vitamin D? You have some of these steroids and you irradiate it, and ergosterol, and with irradiation you call it artificial, but is it artificial or is it natural? You do the same thing in your skin. The person does the same thing, see? So, you make your own. You don't have to buy it. And he says, incidentally, if you a person in business clothes, outdoors 15 minutes a day, make all the vitamin D he needs. And he said, incidentally, if he happens to be a one-armed man, he still makes enough to get by. And so I've often thought of that and used it, just how much vitamin D does an adult really need. Elvium, I had a course from Tottingham. Tottingham was still around in those days. Plant chemistry. Carl came up, took his degree with Tottingham. Plant chemistry. Elvium, don't think I ever had a course from Elvium. He was head of the department when I was there. Successor to Hart. Hart was there when I first came as head of the department, and then Elvium took over replacing Hart, although Hart was still there and doing like emeritus research while Elvium was head of the department.
That's going to be confusing because you left, you said in 39, Elvium became chairman in 44. It may be that Elvium was doing most of the work. Could you mean that?
Elvin.
He didn't become chairman officially until, I think, 44.
You know, of course, because you got the record.
Yeah.
I doubt it, though. I doubt it. Now, I would recommend you check that figure, because it seems very unlikely, to me, very unlikely.
It doesn't matter anyway, it's the sort of thing that
but it's
in
important.
The records. Yeah.
It's important.
Yes.
Let's come back and... And I will, maybe my...
What I mean by saying it doesn't matter is it's something that we can easily find.
Right, maybe yours is the wrong date. Let me, University of Wisconsin...
See, I've got 1944 LVM chairman.
I think it's wrong. As a matter of fact, I'm sure it's wrong. Not only do I think it's wrong, I'm sure it's wrong. See, I was there from
this
period. All right, now... In took my degree in agricultural chemistry, not biochemistry.
It wasn't called biochemistry yet, was it?
My last year, Elvium came in. For my last year, this is after I did the niacin job for him. I would turn to that if you wanted to get to that someday, but that's another little block. Elvin came in one day at my bench and he said, "Campy, you've been here 3 years now, and this year is your fourth year. I understand you're going to receive your PhD." I said, "Well, I hope so." He said, "Well, we have a decision, and we've talked about it, and I'm going to, we have decided that we would leave the option up to you. Last year, the department was renamed biochemistry, as you know." "Yes. Yes, I know that. You are here for 3 years now, 2 years as agricultural chemist, now 1 year as a biochemist. We think it's just fair that you could decide, do you want your name PhD in biochemistry or do you want it in agricultural chemistry?" Well, I still remember the personal computer.
You always
talk about him. What do I want, see? So he's standing there and I stand there and run it through. And my mind seemed to run this channel. Here we got agricultural chemists. McCollum, E.B. Hart, Steinbach, all these very people that I hold in high esteem. They were agricultural chemists. I couldn't go wrong by siding in with them. On the other hand, biochemistry is something new. But you know, it might not last. After all, the department's been renamed, but you know, it might not last. As a professor, I want my degree in agricultural chemistry. And I probably or might be the last agricultural chemist this university ever turned out. I'm not sure, there might have been one or two others. There was one or two others, maybe four of us, that got out that year. And I don't know if they elected to be biochemist or not. I am an agricultural chemist, took my degree in agricultural chemistry, and at that time it was Elvin that came to me.
Yeah. He was
head of the department,
yeah.
Although he may have been, as you point out, may have been acting head of the department, yeah. Or something of that nature. That is true. But it functioned. He functioned at that point as head of the department. Yeah. And so the actual date, I'm not sure. But as I recall and think back, in my mind, he was head of the department acting that way.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And to me, I considered head of the department. Yeah.
Could you have stayed on the faculty?
Was not invited to stay on. I don't know that I was inclined to stay on. I was not told to go. I don't know.
Did any of Blaine's students stay?
I don't know if, go back. I suspect that at that point I had been sufficiently indoctrinated by Speed Marvel, the University of Illinois, that I don't know that I wanted to stay on. Mm. There's a lot of inbreeding that has gone on at Wisconsin.
Oh, yes.
And a lot of inbreeding I had been indoctrinated with that might not be for the best. I came to the University of Wisconsin due to the good offices, services of Speed Marvel at Illinois. Speed had recommended that I go to the East Coast, get my master's, and the West Coast a PhD. But he says, Campy's too late. I have to work with my friends. I have a friend up at Wisconsin. It was my good fortune. I fell in under the tutelage or arm of Carl Paul Link. Very good fortune. I think probably being so indoctrinated, I'd done my thing. I'd isolated that crystal, the dichromo. I believe I was psychologically ready to move on to other things. Mm. And I did.
I don't think any of Link's students stayed.
Pardon?
I don't think any of Link's students stayed, now that I think about it.
Mark is the only one that came back, but that was after
a
tour with Rockefeller Institute.
But he wasn't a friend of Link's.
Pardon?
He wasn't a friend of Link's when he came back. Wasn't that a pretty
I wouldn't that is not correct. That one, the other one I will accept. The fact that you mentioned is not true. Not true. So this is that mosaic that we're talking about.
They continue
about.
To be friends.
That mosaic. Mm. Not forever. But you said when he came back.
Right, all right.
Not forever, but not as it was stated. That's that mosaic. Mark, let's pick up on Mark. Mark went to Rockefeller Institute of Medical Research. Carl had connections there, mm-hmm. good connections. Charlie Heidelberger's father was there, immunologist. Oh, tremendous. Mark went and studied under Carl Nevin just before me. Carl, first round of Carl's students, the first group, Carl Nevin was in those group. He went to Rockefeller and as Carl went to Rockefeller, I came in. Didn't take Carl, no one took anyone's position, but Carl went out and I came in at that time. He studied at Rockefeller for about 4 years. Then he went to Linus Pauling and was in Linus Pauling's laboratory in California, Pasadena, as well, headed up the organic department. Pauling kind of overseer and Carl being second or maybe first in the department. Mark went and studied with, and I'm still trying to pick up the same name, working on proteins and amino acids there at Rockefeller. He spent maybe 3-4 years there, then come the war, war shook us all up, and war, he got, I guess, essentially drafted. We have worked in, I believe, in Bethesda on war assignment. And after that, rather than go back to Rockefeller, he came here. Now, why that choice, I don't know. And what, he came back to Wisconsin, I don't know by what motivated him to do it. He was here at Wisconsin, to my knowledge, not with, under good graces, no problems at all, not any outs with Carl at all. In the department, Carl then, for his bout with tuberculosis, was laid up in a hospital for some time. It was an opportune situation, as you recognize, a favorable, very favorable situation. I can well see, without straining my program on being a psychologist, Mark could envision himself as being heir apparent. Yeah. It was there. The lab was open. It needed him. It needed him. Carl had students there. He needed him. And Mark was the man, as I was the man, microchemistry, when niacin and Elvium, the man of the day and at the time and home to do it, Mark was the man to take over it, not take over, at least he thought he took over, at least fill the gap. And he did. And I think very well. I suspect very well. I don't know. No way to judge it all. Mark continued to teach in the field of amino acids, which is a follow-up of Van Potter's book of amino acids, which he published on, the amino acids. And Van had studied this and taught this course for many years. Mark then, having this experience in Rockefeller on amino acids, there and not here, see, brought this information and interest back, continued to write and publish in this field and do research in this field, and his lecture course was on the amino acids at that time. He did that, but in Carl's lab was available, and it carried on research in that lab. At this point, I do not know detail, but I like my old story of Will Rogers. I read what I read in the newspaper, what I see, what happened. Rest of it's hearsay. Carl, now out of the hospital, back. Carl thought it was his lab. And once upon a time, it was his lab. But who knows why that it isn't still Carl's lab? Stammen been in there, and what a delight! All the fancy equipment and the students, and he can envision himself as, I filled in when I was in need. What am I going to do now? Just fade away? It's not comfortable. There is the makings there of an awkward situation. And with the awkward situation, it turned out awkward. I'll leave it to Mark Stammen to tell you detail. I know them by hearsay. I'd rather you hear them directly from Mark. What the awkward situation led to. But I can, I do understand, I believe, and recognize well the situation. After all, it was Carl's lab. It always was Carl's lab. And I can understand Mark, and he's a good friend of mine. Mark had been a man of the day and filled in. And what a disappointment when you realize is not my lab anymore. University of Wisconsin supplied Stallman with an excellent laboratory of his own in the new wing with as much room as Carl ever had. An excellent situation. But at that point, Mark might not have preferred to have new lab, he might have preferred to have the old one, which never was his own, but I can also see that he might have felt he had inherited an heir apparent and every. I know that's a synthesis on my own part. I'll leave it to Mark to fill in.
I thought it was over the Warfarin patent.
It was, but when Mark came in, he thought he owned Warfarin too, the lab and the Warfarin. He thought he owned the whole inherited the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Yes, of course.
You say that.
But he never had put his hands on the Dykumar project until I left, and we had isolated crystals. He took over at that point. He did work with Carl during the Warfarin days. Right. I think by that time he'd had a PhD, and I guess nowadays we might talk of him as a postdoc. A postdoctoral fellow. I believe he supervised some of these fellows that were making these 48 or 52 compounds as kind of a straw boss supervisor. Whether he owned Warfarin at that point, I don't know. And it was over Warfarin that came to a scuffle, and it had words, but I can understand the situation, and particularly with the way things happened. It never would have happened if Carl hadn't have been out to hospital, because after all there would have been continuity.
Yeah.
But with a lack of continuity, I can well recognize it was a situation just made
yeah.
for maybe misunderstanding and maybe not just misunderstanding an awkward situation.
You have to understand that you ask Mark Stallman about it, but the fact is that he is an interested party.
Oh, of course.
I mean, he would, so what one needs is a third person's view where
I've been open to give that.
Yeah.
And it has taken certain. Well,
so
I learned some things from Carl. Carl was an outspoken person. I claim I'm a candid cuss. Now, you have to be both. There's no point in being one or the other. If you're going to be candid, you better be a cussed enough to speak out. And if you're going to be cussed enough, you better be candid. I've treated you that way. And Carl and Mark is, and his wife, very good friends of ours. And that's the way I can understand the situation. But it's very easy, and I could have got sucked into the same. Well, now we talk about black holes, you know.
Mm.
I could have got sucked into the same situation myself. I don't know. Maybe I would. Maybe I wouldn't.
Mm.
A little. Well, all right. I'll stop there. Maybe I would. Maybe I wouldn't. I got my own bets.
You don't think so?
I didn't. My past. Let's talk about. I'm better at projection mathematically than I am on other things. If my past experience and life course has said something, it wasn't to come back to the old thing or the old thing and the old thing. Every time I've taken a move, it's been to feel that I didn't know anything about, but had guts enough to see what I could deliver to it might be applicable to it. Doubt like hell if I'd ever come back and start to pull in the old little apple cart with a new bag of sugar on it. That doesn't mean I'm not bad-mouthing anybody by that. Other people can live their life differently. But you asked me the question. I don't think I would. I don't think I would have. There has been said, Elizabeth told me this, Link. That Campy was Carl's favorite student.
Oh, that's nice.
I had rapport with Carl. I worked hard for Carl. You read Carl's Harvard lecture. I pulled out for Carl. Dykema, a lot of a haystack. Others could have, but others didn't. Carl has built and established that himself on that, as you well recognize.
Yes.
And Carl knew it. I knew it. Carl, like I, not all good, not all bad. I got hurt at times, but again, I was young at that point, and that's another story. But it is true, Elizabeth has stated that, not just to me, but to others, and it come back to me by, you know, a wrong route. Thinking that, see, it can't be, maybe you'd do this. Elizabeth told me that you'd be the most likely one to do this because of your respect for Carl and what you, high regard you held of Carl, and Campy was Carl's favorite student. Someone at Carl's memorial.